This is Jan Hocken talking today with Jennifer Ruth, professor of film studies at Portland State University, and a scholar who has published extensively on academic freedom and free speech issues. She is co-author with Michael Berube of two books, The Humanities, Higher Education, and Academic Freedom, Three Necessary Arguments, and It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom. And she's co-editor with Valerie Johnson and Alan Schrecker of The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right-Wing War on Academic Freedom, recently released. Well, Jennifer Ruth, welcome to KBOO and again to the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks for having me again, Jan.
Well, at a teach-in at Portland State University on April 29th, you talked about the crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests around the country, and you referred to what you term the Palestine exception. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in mentioning the books that I've co-authored, I work on academic freedom issues, and it's a pretty well-known phrase, the Palestine exception to academic freedom and free speech in academic freedom circles. It's widely used, even by people who are not particularly invested in human rights or justice for Palestinians. And the common use of the phrase speaks to the wide acknowledgement that speech and scholarship around Israel-Palestine is handled differently in the US than other speech and scholarship, and that Palestine and advocacy for Palestine has long served as the limit case for acceptable political advocacy. The phrase draws our attention to the fact that while the law might theoretically protect the right to advocate for Palestinian freedom, powerful social forces will not only punish those who do, they will also punish those who don't act quickly enough to crush pro-Palestinian advocates. And we've seen this since October. Suspensions and expulsions of students who spoke out, the revocation of job offers that were made once students speak out on behalf of Palestine, the doxing campaigns in New York, calling people who have advocated for stopping the genocide, calling them anti-Semites. We've seen the Palestine exception in practice over the last half year. And we've also seen the punishing of those who do not themselves crush pro-Palestinian advocates. So what I mean by that is that if someone in a position of power doesn't move to silence and suppress or discipline Palestinian advocates, they themselves might find themselves on the hot seat. So this began most spectacularly, of course, with the December 5th congressional hearings on anti-Semitism.
And you were on the Old Mole in December, actually, to talk about the congressional hearings that month, where presidents of MIT, Harvard, and UPenn, all women presidents, some new to that position, were interrogated in what you describe as a McCarthyist demand for presidents crack down on what they claim to be rampant anti-Semitism on their campuses. So what about this most recent appearance of Columbia's President Manoush Safiq before the committee last month? She had the benefit of seeing what happened to her colleagues a few months prior and how they responded, many concluded quite badly under fire. How would you describe the scene on April 17th with Columbia's president's testimony?
I was here to talk about the December 5th congressional hearings. And of course, we recall that they were punished, widely humiliated in the mainstream press for their lawyerly-like answers. They said what was actually true, which is that investigations for hate speech, you know, you have to show due process and the context matters. So, for example, you can't presume, as Elise Stefanik clearly tried to sort of channel them into saying, that from the river to the sea is a call for genocide. It isn't. It actually depends on context.
Context became a dirty word in those hearings.
Exactly.
A way of evading taking a firm stance, even though, of course, all of higher education is about understanding context.
Exactly, which shows you how the anti-intellectual fascist movements, right-wing movements in the past have often had an anti-intellectual, anti-higher education component. You know, William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale, the superstitions of academic freedom. So the anti-intellectual aspect of it, the anti-contextualizing aspect of it shouldn't surprise us. And yet,
particularly in this country, we might say.
Right. And yet, so much of the mainstream press just jumped on that as if they were idiots for raising the question of context. And so, April 17th, Columbia University President Shafeek, she proved that she had learned the lesson from the December 5th hearings. And the lesson that she'd learned was to appease, placate, crack down, say that she will discipline students and faculty for speech that really would be dependent on context for how it should be interpreted. She threw students under the bus. She threw specific faculty members under the bus and named them in a congressional hearing, which is probably, I mean, I spent 3 years going with faculty who are under investigation at Portland State for various things. And she has to have broken some kind of laws or rules around privacy and doing that and naming people in a congressional hearing. But she proved that she was not going to make the mistakes they did. She was going to be a toady in Congress and turn around and be a dictator on campus. Now, by learning that lesson, she also found herself learning a new lesson, which is that students refused to be bullied into being complicit in genocide. So students were not going to let her throw them under the bus. They protested, and when she sent the police in to arrest protesters, more students joined, and it sparked a national movement on campuses across the country to speak up on behalf of the genocide of Gazans and also against the US government's complicity in that genocide.
Parenthetically, I watched a program today on Democracy Now! Where the president of Union Theological Seminary, which is affiliated and in a sense part of Columbia, saying the complete opposite position. Their board voted to divest from businesses that deal directly with Israel. They opened their campus to commencements that the Columbia Law students that could not have their commencement or participate on that campus. And it's become, interestingly, a kind of sanctuary within the larger Columbia system for protesters. And so there certainly have, on the positive side, been enormous advances in allies and faculty and student groups speaking up. So, Jennifer, how is this moment different from previous periods when criticism of Israel was suppressed or has been very costly for Palestinian scholars or critics of Israel, critics of Zionism that have been targeted as anti-Semitic, some of whom have lost their jobs or tenure because of that line of scholarship?
That's right. So there's been these sort of eruptions of cases over the years. The boycott, divest, sanction campaign starting in 2005 was one of those moments where there was a crackdown, and various states even passed laws that you can't do business in their state if you have signed on to boycott, divest, and sanction campaigns. So it's been ongoing for quite a while. And so there's been some particularly infamous cases like first Norman Finkelstein at DePaul, who Alan Dershowitz went after. And so Finkelstein, for his work historicizing the crimes against humanity or the atrocities during the Nakba of Israelis, that kind of stuff, he was denied tenure. More recently, Steven Salida was first given a job offer, and then the job offer was taken away because of tweets he'd made critical of Israel. So it's been an ongoing thing. And there's, of course, a very powerful lobbying group, AIPAC, that's involved in pressuring campaigns and creating organized campaigns against people that they see as critical of Israel. But the difference today, the thing that makes this moment different, I think, is the fact that we have a generation that is responding to it so robustly and seems to be savvy to the ways in which pressure gets exerted, to the ways in which the Palestine exception gets exercised. They seem to be savvy to that. They understand that that's what's happening. And it's a generation who is watching in real time on TikTok and other places and Instagram, watching people get bombed, children get pulled out of the rubble, children traumatized. You know, that we have, I think it's like 13,000 children dead, 17,000 orphaned, and who knows how many maimed. The generation today can see this. And the irony is that this is a generation that apparently, and I say this with having done some kind of informal surveying of my students, has internalized the lesson of never again. and is saying, not in my name, never again. I'm seeing a genocide. And what one does when one sees a genocide is tries to protest and stop it and do whatever they can within their power. So whether it be to put pressure on Biden to change his policies through, for example, the Michigan
Uncommitted.
uncommitted, that's right. Or whether it's to pressure your own university to be transparent about its funds and make sure that it's not invested in any, either in anything related to Israel or anything that helps sort of, deliver weapons to Israel, like Boeing. So these students are pretty incredible. What's interesting too to me is that the campaign of Elise Stefanik, Virginia Fox, the ones who are trying to pass things like the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act to try to enforce an overly expansive definition of anti-Semitism, the right-wing campaigns to do that, they've been in high gear trying to demonize this particular generation for at least four, no, like more like 10 years. It's always referred to as the young generation. Of course, that generation's now has changed, but originally the right-wing campaign about around critical race theory, around so-called divisive concepts, mocked this generation for being snowflakes was first said. Then this generation was characterized as an illiberal mob who was cancel culturing everybody. And now, of course, they're pro-Hamas terrorists. There's a lot of work, overdrive going on in trying to demonize the last 10 years of young people, essentially.
There are also lessons in some of the focus on feelings or discomfort in the classroom as a register of oppression. So those who are on this bandwagon about rampant anti-Semitism confusing Jewish students who have a strong identification with Israel, with Zionism, of feeling uncomfortable or unsafe is different from them feeling objectively unsafe. And so we're having to revisit that issue of how you feel unsafe versus objectively being threatened, but through now this assault on probably the most important anti-war movement in decades. So there are lessons around the way in which emotional reactions, what used to be called microaggressions or trigger warnings in the classroom. I mean, those were big debates we had years ago about what students should be able to experience at the level of discomfort in the classroom. And now that argument is being weaponized by pro-Israel Zionists who point to the discomfort of students, of Jewish students. And of course, then Jewish students who are part of this movement say, yeah, we're always uncomfortable when we're confronted with things that are disturbing. And it's very disturbing that we see before our eyes a genocide unfolding. So the fact that you're feeling uncomfortable is it has to do with a struggle you're having and we're all having now.
Yeah, it's all part of the same movement, right-wing movement. So originally calling the students snowflakes because they were actually more sensitive to social injustice than, the so-called adults. Calling them snowflakes, that was the beginning of it. And then it twists to adapt to whatever the movement needs. So it's not worried about consistency. So then during the snowflake moment, the trigger warning moment, there was all of this push to embrace an absolutist notion of free speech. And there was a lot of pressure. There were, bills trying to be passed to protect free speech as if it was under attack. Of course, now the bill is to try to punish speech, punish from the river to the sea, those kinds of things. Consistency doesn't matter in movements like this. It just adapts to, in a kind of dialectical way, what's going on. So we've been, well into a long-term campaign to demonize social and racial justice issues. Before the McCarthyite congressional hearings, we had the Trump executive order on DEI and divisive concepts in 2020. That then, even though it was rescinded by Biden, it just metastasized at the state level. And we had all of the red states and their education gag orders. And we had the kind of gaslighting that of the right wing saying that anti-racism is the new racism against white people. And so the discomfort around divisive concepts was concern around the so-called discomfort of white people. now we're seeing the gaslighting around the from the river to the sea we're being told it's a call for genocide, or that criticism of Zionism is inherently anti-Semitic. All of this kind of gaslighting is continuous with what's been going on around race, but now it's going on around anti-Semitism and in response to the Israel-Palestine conflict, in order to kind of shave off yet another contingent of people who might join with the right wing. Because now this so-called progressive Jewish liberals, some of them might be vulnerable to this kind of propaganda around the students being anti-Semitic and the students calling for genocide. And if you're vulnerable to that, then you might find yourself hand in hand with some of the Christian Zionists and white right-wing Christian nationalists, and people like Chris Ruffo, who's incredibly proud of the fact that he and Bill Ackman are now good buddies after 10/7 and after Ruffo's trying to demonize this generation as pro-Hamas terrorists.
In the recent congressional hearings with chancellors or superintendents of public schools who actually did much better in managing all of this, they're used to being interrogated by communities and legislators. And one Congress person spoke up and said, "You know, I don't hear my colleagues condemning Donald Trump for having a known anti-Semite for dinner. His at Charlottesville saying, well, there are good people on both sides in defending white nationalists who were using overt neo-Nazi symbols and phrases. And the right wing has trafficked heavily in anti-Semitism for a long time in an organized and conscious way." So there's, I think, the blatant hypocrisy of the moment is also quite evident to students who often have more time to think about things and follow things than older people who get glimpses of this through the media.
Another angle on the hypocrisy is that there's a lot of right-wing money right now circulating, posing itself as a solution to the problem of the incivil speech of our students and our students being unable to deliberate in a civil way and have meaningful dialogue with one another. So you pose the problem that they can't do it, and you sort of reference the polarized country, which may or may not, they're less polarized than, people over 30. But you reference the polarized country, you reference their supposed inability to deliberate civilly, and you put money into schools to model civil discourse. When, of course, it's not the students who are saying things like grab them by the like the complete hypocrisy around crass and crude and bullying language of some of the major figures on the right. They're the ones who need the lesson in civil discourse.
As well as much that's in full display. So there's a lot of revisiting of history, the history of the anti-war movement, revisiting questions around tactics in a movement and how to draw on previous eras of struggle, including the anti-apartheid movement around South Africa. And I think there's a lot of interest in the history of Israel and Palestine and the false narrative of Palestinians being offered so many times a two-state solution, turning it down. So I think this is a big teaching moment for a lot of people. And so there's promise as well as peril in this place we're at. And I hope to have you come on the show again and talk further as this unfolds. Thanks so much, Jennifer Ruth, for being with us on the Old Mole Variety Hour today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, the people they won't leave. What is threatening about divesting and wanting peace? The problem isn't the protests, it's what they're protesting. It goes against what our country is funding. Block the barricade until Palestine is free. Block the barricade until served by any means. AIPAC, Koofi, and all the companies. You see, we sell fear around the land of the free. But this generation here is about to cut the strings. You can ban TikTok, take us out the algorithm, but it's too late. We've seen the truth, we bear witness. Seen the rubble, the buildings, the mothers and the children, and all the men that you murdered, and then we see how you spin it. Who gets the right to defend and who gets the right of resistance? It's always been about dollars and the color of your pigment. But white supremacy is finally on blast, screaming free Palestine to their home at last. We see the lies and claiming innocence. anti-Semitic to be anti-Zion. I seen Jewish brothers and sisters out there and writhing in solidarity and screaming free Palestine, with them organizing and learning and finally cutting ties with a state that's gotta rely on apartheid system to uphold and occupy and violent history been repeating for the last 75. The NECPA never ended, the colonizer lied. If students in tents posted on the lawn, occupying the quad is really against the law. And a reason to call and the police and their squad, where does genocide land in your definition, huh? Destroying every college in Gaza and every mosque, pushing everyone into Rafah and dropping bombs. The blood is on your hands, Biden, we can see it all.